Jason, straight up top of the hour, wherever you are. If you're listening on replay, I hope you're enjoying yourself, whatever time of day it is. We have one of our favorite guests. I just love this guy. I love his intelligence. It's very rare that you hear people that talk about political, geopolitical events that you can tell has put a lot of thought into it. And that's why I like James Corbett. And plus, he lives on the other side of the world. He lives in Japan, and that he's kind of away from the bright lights of Uncle Sam filter, so to speak, and can see it from a different perspective, especially Asia. And one of the big things we're going to talk about is North Korea. James Corbett started the Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com. Many important issues, especially he's been all over 9/11 truth, been a great advocate, been just a founding father of the truth movement of alternative media, which is now really turning into main street media, the new media, whatever you want to call it. James, so glad to have you on. Welcome back to the Power Hour.
Well, thank you very much for having me on today. I do appreciate it. And let me just take a moment at the top to give my condolences to the entire Power Hour crew and, of course, all the listeners out there who are feeling the loss of Joyce Riley. I myself also feel that loss. I've been coming on this program for several years now and have always been delighted with my conversations with Joyce. She was such a bright light in this movement and not only extremely knowledgeable about all of the vast array of topics that we talk about, but also just such a committed bright leading light of this independent media movement. And so her loss is greatly felt.
Well, thank you for that, James. That's very kind of you. You know, I don't know if you knew this, yesterday would have been her birthday.
I did not know that. Wow.
So there you go. Very appropriate. But, thank you. Thank you very much for that. The Power Hour Nation is very, very saddened. But we're going forward, and we're going forward with you right now. Thank you for coming on. North Korea. Now, we hear everything from this guy as Satan himself to, Santa Claus' evil twin brother, Kim, over there in North Korea. They've been characterized as such an evil regime, but yet they've been in power basically for decades. What are we missing there in North Korea? What really is North Korea?
Well, let's think about this from a bit of a wider historical perspective than we usually do, because, of course, we're in the 24/7 news cycle of era in which all history lasts about a week, and anything before that is just, oh, that's so ancient history, why are you talking about that? But how can we understand, as you say, the survival of this North Korean regime, because, of course, any government that the United States doesn't like is a regime, how can we describe the stability or relative stability of this government, despite over half a century now of outright aggression and sanctions and the determined effort of the United States and its allies to try to basically squash this country? I think it does a huge disservice to us to think of this just as some crazy family that's managed to take over this country and has held it hostage for over half a century. There's clearly more to it than this. And if we really want to drill down on the North Korean nuclear issue in particular, we have to understand that the North Korean nuclear issue started in June of 1957. Because that is the exact time at which the United States, on behalf of the United Nations Command, which is one of the signatories to the Armistice Agreement, because of course the Korean War never ended, there was just a ceasefire of sorts, and the United States informed the North Koreans that they no longer felt bound by the rules of that Armistice Agreement, specifically paragraph 13D, which specifically forbid the introduction of any new weapons onto the Korean Peninsula, either on the northern side or the southern side. There were provisions for piece-by-piece replacement of any existing military equipment on the peninsula, but there was no new weaponry supposed to be introduced by the bounds of this agreement. And specifically, no nuclear missiles, no nuclear-equipped weapons of any sort.
We got a break, James. We got a quick break. This is a short segment, long segment coming up. Let's pause right there. The history you're giving, I think, is very important. Let's get that on the other side. 3-minute break with James Corbett, The Corbett Report. North Korea, what is the reality of what we're dealing with? Stay tuned. Welcome Welcome back to the Power Hour. 8 minutes after the hour, we are talking to the very unique and important voice in independent media, James Corbett, the CorbettReport.com. He was talking about the history of North Korea. You know, we asked the question. For decades, his family has been ruling North Korea, basically, I mean, more or less. We've made them out to be complete lunatics, but yet they're still in power. They haven't been thrown out. You know, that says something in this day and age. James was giving us a little history about the armistice in 1957 and where that went. Why don't you continue?
So in 1957, the U.S. came in and unilaterally told North Korea, we're going to break the armistice agreement, specifically the clause that prevents the introduction of any new weaponry, specifically the introduction of nuclear weaponry. And in 1958, January of 1958, they wheeled in a bunch of nuclear-armed Honest John missiles and some atomic cannons. They deployed them in South Korea, pointed obviously at North Korea. So that was the introduction of nuclear weaponry to the Korean Peninsula. And the year after that, they added some cruise missiles, some nuclear-tipped cruise missiles to that arsenal, just to add a little bit of fuel to the fire. And of course, as a side note, those cruise missiles were, of course, within range of China and the Soviet Union, obviously in the midst of the Cold War. So that was a pretty important escalation that took place with, of course, the approval of the U.S. National Security Council and signed off on by President Eisenhower. So that was the start of the North Korean nuclear drama, the issue that we see playing out today. Nukes have been a part of the Korean Peninsula equation for a very, very, very long time. It's just that the only nukes that were really operative and important, at least in the first few decades until China started to work on its arsenal and developed its technology, the really only nukes that mattered were the U.S. side. But now, of course, it's the North Korean side of the equation, so everyone's freaking out. And it's also important to understand, for anyone who is genuinely freaking out about the North Korean nuclear capabilities, at this point, we are talking essentially about nuclear firecrackers. I mean, we're talking about things that are fractions of the what we've seen tested so far were fractions of the size of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki explosions, which, by the way, by the terms of today's weaponry, is extremely small. And also, of course, they haven't managed to miniaturize that into a warhead that would fit on any of these missiles that they're test firing. And the ICBM tests, the Hwasong-14 that they've tested twice now, although it theoretically seems to have a range of maybe 6,000 miles, essentially, it's using the same type of guidance technology that their medium-range missiles are using. So what these are, essentially, are medium-range missiles with an extra stage of fuel that allows them to travel further. But they're, at this point, they don't have the guidance technology to reliably hit a target 6,000 miles away. And, in fact, the latest test broke up on re-entry, so it seems they haven't even gotten re-entry of these ICBMs down yet. So they're a long way off technologically from being an actual imminent threat to the United States, however much the media might be hyping it right now.
Well, Seoul, the capital of South Korea, which the majority of the population there lives, is very close to North Korea, very close to the demilitarized zone. How are Korean relations right now, North and South Korea? How tense is it, or is it not as tense as we may believe?
I suppose that's a matter of perception, but my sense is that it is not the type of relation that might be expected from the outside, from the U.S. or elsewhere. And I say that because, of course, we think of these armies lined up on the DMZ and they're at each other's throats and all these warnings and everything, but we don't see the other side of this, which is the genuine attempts that have been made over the years to try to reconcile North and South Korea in some way, at least the olive branches. And there have been numerous things that have been tried out to greater or lesser successes. There have been even jointly run corporations or companies manufacturing things in the demilitarized zone, sending in people from the South and the North to work in these factories. There's been a number of initiatives like that that have enjoyed some amount of success, at least for a time, until the U.S. starts ramping up military tensions and North Koreans get angry and respond. So I think the most interesting part of this is, of course, we just saw the changeover of power in South Korea with a new president coming in, the last one being impeached and ultimately jailed. because of a scandal that was taking place there. The new president came in on the back of a promise to revivify something called the Sunshine Policy, basically this attempt to try to get engage North Korea in some way that's productive, that maybe there can be some sort of economic agreement reached or something along the way toward creating some sort of diplomacy between North and South Korea. Because at the end of the day, what happens at the Korean Peninsula should be the up to the Korean people, and the Korean people still feel as one, there are one people divided by the 38th parallel, and it's kind of one of those travesties of justice, of history, that for whatever reason, the United States and China use the Korean Peninsula as this kind of proxy square of the chessboard, that clearly the Korean issue is not just about Korea. It's about China, it's about the US, it's about NATO power relations and sort of the bigger picture. And the Koreans kind of get excluded from that. So I think the tension, the kind of at-your-throat, slit-your-throat tension between the two sides is not quite there in the way that people might expect it from the outside. I think still, there's still the hope, at any rate, that the South and North Korea might actually be able to negotiate a peace together without worrying about what China and the U.S. are doing.
Why such provocative innuendos or slash threats, whatever you want to call them, from North Korea towards America? You know, it's not like we're choir boys. I'm not saying that. But there has been some very pretty provocative things coming out of North Korea directed towards the United States. Why do you think that is?
Absolutely. Well, people might have seen some of the propaganda that gets thrown out there from the North Korean side that could be quite over the top with depictions of the White House being blown up and things like this. And so clearly, yes, clearly there are some threats coming out of North Korea. And I think one thing to understand from this is that these ramp ups in threats and tensions nearly always take place directly at the time of or directly after the South Korean U.S. military joint drills that they run every single year in South Korea. They run this joint exercise, a military exercise, that is a simulation of basically the invasion of North Korea. And they do all sorts of things, including even using the B-1B nuclear bombers to drop dummy nuclear munitions on the Korean Peninsula in preparation for, you know, the doomsday when we come and bomb North Korea off the face of the planet. And it is in that context that North Korea generally comes out with its chest beating and we're going to, you know, destroy the United States. And of course, the only side of that that ever gets reported generally in the U.S. press, or at least the mainstream press, is, hey, look at these crazy North Koreans. All of a sudden, they're trying to ramp up tensions. So there's always that excluded factor in this. And I think the other thing, putting that historical piece that we talked about earlier into the puzzle, if you look back to 1957, it was the Americans who started the Korean nuclear issue, and North Korea has been sitting there for decades and decades watching as country after country, Gaddafi's Libya or Saddam Hussein's Iraq, or, you know, pick your example, has tried to work with or cooperate with the United States, has let in weapons inspectors, and, oh, we're disarmed, you know, nothing here. And regardless, these countries get destroyed and pummeled off the face of the planet. And the only thing that seems to prevent that is a nuclear arsenal. And so there is a rationality to the North Korean development of the nuclear arsenal. And again, that rationality is never really looked at from the U.S. mainstream perspective.
Well, whether it's 1957 or 2017 today, you get the feeling that the actions over there are THAAD system now, the nuclear weapons in the 50s. It's really not about North Korea at all. You mentioned China. Let's get to China. I've always had in the back of my mind, is China not pulling their string? Are they? There's no way they can be North Korea can be completely independent from China. I mean, is this all a chess game between China and the United States? Where does China fit into this?
Well, North Korea certainly could not exist without the economic help that it gets from China. Specifically, North Korea exports coal and some other minerals to China, and that's the main part of its exports to China. And obviously, without that economic lifeline, the North Korean government would not be able to function. So that is an important, absolutely essential piece of this puzzle. And I think China definitely has an interest in keeping North Korea propped up as a bulwark, as some sort of barrier between the U.S. military there on South Korea and China's doorstep, but also, of course, the ever-present risk of a collapse of North Korea, meaning millions of 25 million North Korean refugees essentially fleeing into China, which obviously China would not be happy trying to deal with that sort of situation. So China, like, obviously wants to keep North Korea propped up to some extent, and they do hold the ace card. They could, if they wanted to, completely and utterly block the borders or implement the international sanctions 100% stringently and essentially cause the collapse of North Korea. But as I say, that's not really in their interest. So I think China is a deciding factor in this. But at the same time, I don't think they are directing the shots. I don't think they're calling the shots or telling Kim Jong-un or anyone else what to say or how to say it. I think there's some degree to which there is a genuine kind of different government in place in North Korea that wants to act as if it is completely independent, even if, you know, it requires that economic lifeline.
What do you make of Donald Trump tweeting about China, kind of disappointed with their, like you said, if China wanted to squash this, they could squash this. They're not. What does that say about United States-China relations? Obviously, China is not dancing to our tune here.
No, and China has just recently hit back on that front with the China's ambassador to the UN basically saying that this isn't about us, this is about you guys, this is not an issue for us to decide unilaterally. The US and North Korea are the ones with the tensions, so you guys should be sorting it out. So there's that side of it. But I think one of the interesting things that underlie this is the assumption that anything that actually draws the North Korean people out of poverty must be a bad thing. That's kind of the interesting underlying assumption of this, because, in fact, Rumsfeld, back when he was defense secretary, used to...
We got a break, James. Let's finish that. Yeah, let's get into Rumsfeld, because I know he was involved with was ABB in the 90s, getting that that's nuclear right. reactor there, I think. We'll be back, or early 2000s, I can't remember. We'll be back after this four-minute break. Welcome back to the Power Hour, 24 minutes after the hour. Turning Japanese, that's where we are headed for some information. James Corbett, of course, lives in Japan and has that perspective over there in that part of the world, which we seem to know little of the truth, or we see it through the Uncle Sam filter, I like to call it. And, James, you were talking about Donald Rumsfeld being involved. Why don't you go ahead and finish that thought in North Korea and then Japan. What does Japan think about all this?
Well, I just wanted to relate the story of Donald Rumsfeld having in his office back when he was defense secretary, he kept the satellite picture of North Korea and, well, of the Korean Peninsula at nighttime. And of course, famously, if you have a picture of that, it's South Korea lit up like a torch, but it's North Korea is just completely black, except for the little dot of light in Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. And Rumsfeld used that as a demonstration. Look, these guys are backwards. They're not really a functioning country, by any measure. Look at them. Look at how not advanced they are. And Fox News has a recent story up just published in the last few hours. North Korea's night lights show improving economy despite sanctions. And they have a side-by-side comparison of the 2002 picture to 2012. And you see there's a little bit more light in North Korea at nighttime now. And they're talking about how this is a, you know, proof positive that there is a growing economy there and urbanization, population density, economic activity, what have you. There's a couple of interesting things to take away from that story. One is, kind of as a side note, what is it that we have to do every year in Earth Hour as commemoration to, you know, Gaia? We have to turn out the lights, guys, because that's the way to show that, we're going to combat climate change by going back into the Stone Age, apparently. So that's an interesting side note to that. But the other factor of this is that what they're essentially saying is that things that actually improve the life of the North Korean people and actually prevent them from getting to the starvation point, which North Korea has been at for a very long time, is a bad thing. We don't want that to happen because that means the bad guys will win. There's something twisted about that. There's something bad about that. I understand the idea of being opposed to a government, but when you are opposed to the people who are suffering under the government that you don't like, there's something pathological about that, and perhaps best reflected back in, of course, the famous statement by Madeleine Albright about, you know, this the Iraqi sanctions back in the 90s killing 500,000 children Was it worth it? Well, it's a difficult decision, but we think the price was worth it. When you start casually, glibly talking about the death of 500,000 children because it suits your short-term geopolitical interests, I mean, that is a sign of incipient psychopathy.
Japan. What does Japan think about all this going on? Where's their place in this? If any.
So Japan, of course, is sitting here, obviously, front row seats, and with the possibility of these ICBMs being lobbed over their heads and or coming down on their heads. Because, of course, sitting here in Japan, we have many U.S. bases that would make nice sitting duck targets that wouldn't require ICBMs, but any of the arsenal of the North Koreans would be able to reach Japan quite handily and do some damage to some U.S. military while they're at it. So obviously, this is a huge concern here in Japan. And I think the added level of concern here is about, well, the Trump administration is still an unknown factor. And of course, there's always this talk about, well, we have to make them pay for their own defense or provide their own defense. And so at this point, Japan is still trying to figure out what exactly that means. Are you going to take away the American military umbrella? And what does that mean in terms of Japan and how it's going to react to all of this? So basically, I mean, in Japan, it's the dual worry. It's the worry from both sides. The worry, of course, of the North Korean threat itself, but also the worry of how the American government is going to react to all of this. And then even the third worry behind all of this, which is, of course, the rise of China as a military power, which is, I think, attendant to all of this. So Japan is kind of responding by slowly militarizing, and I don't mean that in the sense necessarily building up its military capacity. It already has quite a large military capacity with its so-called self-defense force, which is officially not a military, but it's just not a military in all but name. I mean, it can act as a military when it needs to, and the Japanese public is slowly coming around to the idea that it does need an operative offensive military capability, which is quite a changeover for a Japanese population that's been, you know, talked about, basically thinks of itself as a pacifist nation now.
Just yes or no, just would Japan like it if America just withdrew completely all the bases out of Japan?
Some people would very much like it. The Japanese politician class would not.
Okay, good. We'll be back after this 3-minute break. James Corbett, the CorbettReport.com. And getting back to James. James, let's switch gears a little bit to Syria, to Russia. Congress is really and truly talking about having sanctions to Russia, trying to tag this whole Russian interference on them. Russia responded, well, 700 and plus of your people are going to have to leave the country now, leave Russia, leave the embassies. What do you make of these sanctions?
Well, I mean, the first thing to note is that the way you phrased it is, of course, the way that it's being reported, that Russia is kicking out several hundred U.S. diplomats from Russia. I mean, first of all, why are there over 1,200 diplomats there in the first place? Oh, it's because, of course, famously, diplomats are, generally speaking, polite language for spies. I mean, generally speaking, the State Department is infested with CIA agents who populate these various embassies. That's almost always their cover, because, of course, they have diplomatic immunity and can do all sorts of things under that cover. Everyone knows it. It's the unspoken truth of the diplomatic community, and that's why there are over 1,000 spies essentially working in Russia. Anyway, so that's, of course, one part of that they'll never tell you. But the other part is that the 755 number is not being pulled out of a hat. They are specifically reaching parity with the U.S. The U.S. has 400. Russia has 400 and whatever it is, 50 or so diplomats, quote unquote, in Washington or in the United States. So they're allowing the same number of U.S. diplomats in Russia. So they're just implementing this sort of parity thing. So it sounds like this dramatic move out of nowhere, and they're, oh, kicking out hundreds of diplomats, a big affront. Well, yeah, it's kind of, I mean, if you know the full picture of it, they're just actually trying to reach the same level as the United States. But secondly, I mean, obviously there is a big move going on here. And I think the most fascinating part of this is actually not about the U.S. or Russia. It's about Europe. Because one of the things specifically that this bill touches on, this bill actually also talks about North Korea and Iranian sanctions, but in the section talking about Russian sanctions. It specifically talks about special Russian crude oil projects, which to the Eurocrats in Brussels means Nord Stream 2. And if you don't know Nord Stream 2, well, there is a Nord Stream 1. It is a gas pipeline, well, technically two parallel pipelines that provide 1.9 or have a capacity of 1.9 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. That capacity is not being used, but I think that's because of diplomatic and other issues. But at any rate, that's the capacity. And there's an expansion of those pipelines that are being revved up. And the pipeline runs from Vyborg in Russia. It's a Russian port town, to Greifswald in Germany. It's a German university city. So it literally connects Russia to Europe, to Germany specifically. And the extension of this Nord Stream pipeline, this Nord Stream 2, is this special Russian crude oil project that involves a lot of European construction companies and others are involved in this project and committing a lot of resources to it. These sanctions, depending how they are implemented, could at least theoretically be wielded against a lot of European countries that are involved in this pipeline expansion. And secondarily, I mean, it sort of, in a way, if not outright criminalizes, at least makes a lot harder these types of pipeline projects that actually get natural gas into the EU. The logical extension of this is, well, where's the EU going to make up the difference? How are they going to get this crude oil or this natural gas or the energy reserves?
Let me take one guess. Let me take one guess, James. The United States of America.
Bingo! There you go. Of course, because the U.S. is now becoming one of the largest exporters in the world in terms of its natural gas and crude oil exports. It is now starting to, I think it's third place at the moment, and projected to even rise higher than that in the coming decades, because the U.S. is booming with all this shale oil and all of this other stuff that's being dug out now. And it works out perfectly for the U.S. It doesn't work out so well for the EU, and the EU recognizes this. That's one of the interesting parts of this. The EU is has been apoplectic about this. They've been talking about retaliation of some sort, or that these sanctions go too far. So, I mean, the Russian-U.S. Cold War II game that's going on, I mean, it's interesting in and of itself. But the interesting part to me is that this puts the EU in an interesting position where it is increasingly being forced to take a side, and it's not 100% necessarily clear that the EU will necessarily pick the US side in this, because certainly Germany, at any rate, is starting to find a very willing trading partner in China and needs energy resources from Russia. There, I think there is a shift that is happening from the EU perspective, from the US, the Atlantic Alliance, to Eurasia as the core nexus of global geopolitics, which is not surprising. If you've studied geopolitics, you know that the Eurasian area, the global heartland, is the kind of prized square on the chessboard because it represents the center of the world geopolitically. It always has throughout human history, and it looks like it's going that way once again.
At what point we're getting there? What you're telling me is we're getting close to the point where the rest of the world realizes they don't need the United States. Yes, and how close are we to that day?
It's obviously impossible to predict the exact turnover date, but we are getting closer, and I think that's measurable in a number of ways. We've seen a lot of projects that Russia and China are explicitly working on, obviously things like the BRICS Bank or China's Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, which are touted as rivals to the World Bank IMF nexus. In fact, they actually cooperate with the World Bank and IMF, and they have agreements with them, and they share board members and all of that, But at any rate, there it's kind of lip service to this alternate system, and China has talked about creating its own alternative to the SWIFT network, the banking communication network that basically all global connected banks use to transmit information around the world. Well, for example, a few years ago, Iran found out, well, they're very vulnerable to that because Iran was cut off of the SWIFT network. So all of their banks had to go back to telephoning orders through to banks around the world and things like this. So that was obviously a huge vulnerability. China came out and said, we're going to start our own SWIFT network. And now they have some kind of version of that. which has recently basically become a part of the Swift network and agrees to use the Swift infrastructure. So a lot of these things they announce as these alternatives actually end up being subsumed into the existing structure. But at any rate, there's this creation of a perception that there is this new, whatever you want to call it, some kind of BRICS countermeasure to the sort of NATO, World Bank, IMF hegemony. And that's clearly the narrative for the 21st century. It's clearly going to be this new multipolar world and all of this. But as you can tell from the way I'm putting this, I think it's a lot of smoke and mirrors, and it's going to be the same people who are puppeteering it, either way.
So it's like the Who song, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, basically, is what you're telling me.
Pretty much. In fact, it might even be worse when you think about it, because, as terrible as things are from a freedom perspective in a lot of the West at this point, it's still not quite as in your face as, for example, the Chinese Communist Party, which just the levels of control that they exert over their population is galling. And, one of those stories that caught my eye recently that just reflect this, that's nothing new, but it's just something to remind us. China just recently closed down 3,918 illegal websites operating behind the Chinese, the Great Firewall of China. And by illegal, they don't mean, whatever, child pornography or gun sales or anything of that sort. They mean thought crime, essentially, anything that's not approved by the Chinese government. So they've been cracking down on these video sharing services that were sharing, Japanese anime programs and Western television shows and things, because, of course, that's thought crime. You can't have these cultural influences from outside. So only government-approved things can be shared on these services now. That's just the kind of blatant example of the type of mindset and ultimately, the model for the New World Order, as it has been specifically referred to by a number of people over the years, David Rockefeller praising Mao Zedong and his great social experiment, George Soros on numerous occasions calling China the engine of the New World Order. This is the model that they are using, and this is ultimately what I think they want to engineer the West into, is that type of ultimate complete control by the government.
Well, great point. So let me go backwards real quick. Don't spend a lot of time on it, but blockchain, Bitcoin, are we going to see the financial instruments turn towards blockchain, whether they incorporate the Bitcoin or not? They're going to have their own blockchain technology?
That remains to be seen, but it is becoming more and more likely that what we are going to see is, rather than public and permissionless blockchains, the actual ideal of what this decentralization is supposed to be, we're going to hear a lot of these big banks creating their own blockchains in order to create, basically networks that they can use for their own purposes, but will still be centralized. They will still be the only ones with actual access to the ledger itself, and they'll be the ones running it. So it'll be just a new window dressing. It'll make things slightly more efficient for them behind the scenes, but it'll make no difference to the average customer. And the worst part is that people associate, anytime they hear, this big banking institution is testing out their a blockchain, people have been trained to associate that with Bitcoin, with the idea of this decentralized, this structure that really can, in every facet, replace the banking system, completely remove the need for this banking system as we know it. Every function of banking that the average person uses today, deposits and loans and foreign exchanges and funds transfers, can be done in a completely peer-to-peer, decentralized, trustless fashion that does not require banks. It can and is being done right now, but only if you know about it, and only if you know how to use it, and only if you know why you need to do that to get out of the banking system in the way that it's being used. And unfortunately, not a lot of people are at that level of consciousness.
This is kind of reminding me of Napster. If you remember Napster, the music, for those of you who may not know who's listening, the music file sharing that came in the 90s, where you could basically give away your music to anybody across the web and it would just go back and forth. The music industry let that go for a long time, and then they cracked down on it, and then they had the replacement, Apple iTunes or what have you. And it's almost like this whole Bitcoin, they're letting it happen. Or maybe they're forced to let it happen so that it's like the Napster to the music industry. They're letting it so people get used to it, and then they'll come in and hammer it down and then put in their own replacement so that people are already integrated into it. Do you see kind of comparisons there?
Well, specifically what they are going to do is to take every access point, every intermediary point between Bitcoin or whatever coin and the fiat funny money currency, and of course just act as the policeman at those nexus points, as they always have and always will. So if you want to buy into this using your fiat currency, or if you want to get fiat currency out of that system, you'll have to go through an exchange that will be, you know, it'll require 15 pieces of ID, and the government will see everything you do. That really doesn't limit the ability of people to use these types of technologies for what they're supposed to be for, which is direct, as a type of cash for the internet, direct transfer from wallet to wallet that doesn't require any permission, and that is nothing but strings of numbers and letters that are pseudonymous, we'll say, not anonymous, but pseudonymous, and are at least capable of masking people's identity. That is what this is supposed to be used for. But of course, people want to use it as an investment. People think of it as, oh, I'll buy some Bitcoin, or oh, I'll sell some of my Bitcoin. And at every time you want to get in or out of that system like that, they're basically going to be the policemen of that. So it's going to be extremely, and it is increasingly already extremely policed at those central nexus points. But it doesn't limit its ability to be used for what it's actually supposed to be used for.
Well, let's change gears again. Let's go to the big news of the day over here. And what's your thoughts living in Japan, seeing it from afar? Supposedly, the Trump administration is seriously considering withdrawing out of Afghanistan completely. Complete troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. One, do you think this is real? And what does this say about the administration? I mean, a real startling announcement.
I will believe it when I see it. Because we have heard just about every iteration of everything that can be thought of about Afghanistan over the past few months, including slight troop increases, large troop increases, an entirely separate plan that has apparently been pitched by Eric Prince of Blackwater fame, now part of the Frontier Services Group, that would replace the entire U.S. troop presence with mercenaries, or at least a vast majority of the troops with mercenaries to do the dirty work. And other iterations of, well, we'll just use drone strikes and special forces raids and kind of get the troops out of there. And now they're talking about some iteration of that where, we might pull out, at least theoretically, we'll pull out the ground troops at any rate. But again, I'll believe it when I see it. All of these different plans have been floated recently. It smacks to me like they're looking for some sort of out that will... that will float with the public. And I think these types of, oh, we're thinking of doing this, we're thinking of doing that, are trial balloons, and they're just trying to see if anything will stick. If anything, it does actually present the possibility that they are at least looking for an out at the longest military confrontation in the history of the United States, which is a remarkable fact that most people don't think about, but really should. 16 years of military presence in Afghanistan to oust Osama bin Laden? No, wait, no. We killed him and threw him in a river before anyone could see. I don't know why we're there, but we got to stay there.
Well, that, we're coming up on a break about a half minute, but do you think that quickly, do you think the death threats to Trump are real? Is the deep state really that aggravated him? Are they really coming against him like it appears, or is this a ruse?
I think some form of ruse, and that doesn't mean that it can't happen. It just means I don't think the deep state cares about Trump per se. I think it's just a question, a calculation of how much chaos would this throw the country into, and do they want that chaos? And at the point at which I think they do want that, then it could happen. But it could have happened under Obama, and I wouldn't have been surprised per se. I don't think it's about the puppet in power. I think it's fundamentally about the deep state and what they want to accomplish.
James Corbett, you see why I love this guy. Just very intelligent, very thoughtful. You can talk about just about anything. TheCorbettReport.com. We'll be back after this 3-minute break. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Power Hour. Minutes after the hour. I just talked to James during the break, and he's been gracious enough to give us a little more of his time, so we're going to go through this 5 minutes, and then the first 5 minutes of the next hour with James Corbett, because we're going to really talk about, I think it's a very important subject. Time gets away from us. There's a million important subjects. Facebook just had an AI project, an artificial intelligence project with computers. those little buggers started inventing their own language, and they shut, and the developers couldn't understand it, and they freaked out and they shut down the project. Where is robots going from Burger King all the way to implants in our minds? Where are we with AI, and is this a threat, James?
Well, let's take that story, because I'm sure everyone's heard about it by now, or at least seen the headlines. And I saw an interesting story about it just yesterday on Gizmodo, where the headline is, "No, Facebook did not panic and shut down an AI program that was getting dangerously smart." And essentially what this article is saying is, it's not as bad. People are hyping this up like this is some kind of crazy thing. These chatbots created their own language and we're going to take over the earth or something. It's not really like that. Essentially what Facebook were doing, they were trying to create chatbots that could create a negotiation with an actual human being and complete the negotiation without the human even really realizing they're chatting to a chatbot. Can you get that level of chatbotness? And so what they're doing is they're using this generative adversarial network technique. Basically, it learns from the responses that it gets and adapts itself to them. And it set two of these bots that learn from each other against each other. So the bots were learning from each other, and eventually they started generating their own language because they didn't put parameters in to say, no, you must stick to the kind of basic English grammar. So they started coming up with these crazy sentences. Balls have zero to me, to me, to me, to me, you, I, everything else. And it sounds crazy when you hear it, but no, what they were doing is they were negotiating with each other, and they basically developed their own way of doing that. And so this article is trying to say, no, it's not the robot take over, don't worry. But it really doesn't do anything to allay my fears about this kind of story, because actually they really did develop their own grammar, their own ideas, their own way of negotiating between each other. And from the outside, the researchers weren't exactly sure what they were doing. They could guess at what these types of statements they were coming up with meant, but they didn't exactly know. And no, they weren't planning to take over the world or anything. They were just working within the framework of the negotiation that they were supposed to be working on, involving books and hats and balls and which ones will go to which people, or bots in this case. But at any rate, it is a creepy story. No matter how much they try to tell you, it isn't creepy. And there is something creepy about this technology. And I keep vacillating to some extent, because I keep hearing from people, no, AI is not as advanced as people think it is, and it's all hype, and they're just trying to sell you on the next big fear. And I do agree, they always are looking for a new boogeyman to try to, you know, clamp down on people's freedom more, even more so with. So maybe this is some sort of one of those false flag agendas. But at the same time, I think there is something to these machine learning software, and there is something new that is taking place here. And although I disagree with Kurzweil and those kinds of transhumanists and all of those people, the singularity and all of that on many things, one thing I do agree is that technology really does advance, not arithmetically, but geometrically. It advances so quickly, and it snowballs on itself, that within 10 years... These kind of really simple experiments they're doing now will be much more advanced. And when you start combining that with military software and things like that, the implications are, I mean, we really do need to be thinking about this as a species, as a civilization right now.
Well, it sounds a lot like Terminator to me, Skynet, how that movie started. If you remember, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, that's what it's that. I'm freaked out about this. I just watched the movie Ghost in the Shell with Scarlett Johansson, and it was in the future, and there's nothing like a movie kind of to put it in your mind, but they had humans with, implants in them, in their heads, and they allowed them to see. They were basically cyborgs walking around. We got a quick break, and then right back to James Corbett, 5 minute, last section. We are the one and only James Corbett from the Corbett Report. Stay tuned. Good morning, Power Hour Nation. Straight up top of the hour. Third and final hour this morning. We are going to go to Wayne Blakely from Living Streams Probiotic here momentarily, but we're finishing up with James Corbett. Been a great interview. If you are doing this in hours and you're looking at podcasts, go back to the second hour today, the first of the month, 8/1/2017. You can hear this very insightful interview with James. James, I'm getting a lot of emails about Fukushima update. One email asked a question that, you know, Japan has towers to test nuclear radiation in case of bombs, in case something goes off in North Korea. Can they not pick up radiation from Fukushima also? Or are they lying about it or what? I know you live there, but what's going on with Fukushima right now?
Well, it's interesting, actually. There is and has been a network here in Japan to detect nuclear disasters of various sorts, and of course, including the possibility of a nuclear meltdown here in Japan, which of course we saw with the triple meltdown at Fukushima. And I know the details of this, but it's been a year since I've articulated them. But essentially, the network provides the ability to forecast radiation exposure and releases and, you know, which way the wind's blowing and all of that. And the Japanese government had that information. And of course, TEPCO itself knew that absolutely knew that there was a triple meltdown within 24 hours. They didn't reveal it to the public for months. So they had all this information. But they did not give it to the press. They did not give it out to the public in the first few days after the meltdowns, when all of this radioactive material was drifting over Tokyo and all of that. They didn't give those actual forecasts that they had to the public, which is kind of begs the question, what's even the point of them? It's just so that the Japanese government has a better idea of, you know, how many people are going to die in the event of some disaster, and the people are left out of that. So that was something of an issue. But of course, now that's years in the past. That's ancient times by the 24/7 news cycle. So at any rate, yes, these detectors are here in the country.
We've heard everything that this is going to be an extinction level event, to this is going to blow over in 30 or 40 years. What is the truth there? And your interesting news point. We got about 2.5 minutes.
I would say I'm of neither the everything's fine nor the extinction level event. I think this is a problem. Obviously, it's not going away. I'll believe the idea that they can actually remove the core material when they can even get close enough to really detect where it's lying, let alone how they're going to remove it. But the idea that this is an extinction level event, the Pacific Ocean is dead, all of that is largely fear-mongering, fear sells, and a lot of people are buying. So I think there's been a lot of that kind of hyping that's gone on in the wake of this as well. If people are looking for good info about this, there's a site called simplyinfo.org that has a lot of very detailed information and goes through all of the latest TEPCO releases about what's going on at the plant and the different things that the information that's being released and not being released and all of that. And the news that people might have heard about recently, it was portrayed in some sectors of the alt media that there's a new leak at the Fukushima Unit 2 and/or 3, and people were kind of freaking out about that, but it was a misinterpretation of a story. Essentially, they've been sending in robots to try to look for where the cores actually are, hopefully in the containment vessels, and these robots have been going in and dying and going in and dying and going in and dying because they can't get close enough because the radiation is too high in there. Well, they've actually managed to get some footage out from within the reactor vessel itself of Unit 2 and Unit 3, I believe. And they have seen what looks like some of the melted fuel, or what could be some of the melted fuel. And that was the new thing that they detected that they hadn't been able to detect before. And by the kind of telephone game that gets played online, that gets turned into a leak, a new source of material or something. No, it's just that they are getting closer to actually seeing where these cores actually are lying.
There's the music, James.
Okay.
There's the music. We got to go. It's been fantastic to have you on. God bless you and Godspeed, and take care over there.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here.